I hope to lead us on an expedition to Darfur, a troubled part of the world which until recently had received little attention from outsiders. I should mention that I have visited the place for extended periods several times during the 1970s, but not since. I have written two books about Darfur in collaboration with Dr. Lidvin Kaptainz of Wellesley College. I have presently under consideration at the International Journal of African Historical Studies an article-length treatment of the century of Darfur rule over the eastern province of Kordofan from about 1720 to 1821. I am not an expert on current events. I am not associated with any government or non-governmental organization. Let me begin with a few comments about the region in early times, meaning up to the end of the period Europeans call the Middle Ages. The highlands of eastern Chad and western Sudan form a peninsula of comparatively fertile terrain, thrusting far northward into Saharan latitudes. The people who live there are the descendants of an ancient speech community called Nilo-Saharan, who during the last Saharan wet phase inhabited a vast T-shaped zone from Senegal to the Nile, and from there both north toward the Mediterranean and south across the lake region of East Africa. They practiced a Mesolithic riparian culture that emphasized fishing and the hunting of aquatic animals. Perhaps their greatest gift to the future was the art of ceramics, for these seemed to be the folk who first invented pottery. A second accomplishment, at least at some locations, was the creation of large permanent settlements. Where 1,000 people or more lived together for centuries on end, it is very probable that the older band society, characteristic of most hunting communities, must have been replaced by a society based upon lineage groups. But with the desiccation of the Sahara, the lifestyle of most Nilo-Saharans changed and changed radically. Food production through the cultivation of crops and animal husbandry replaced hunting and gathering, and lineage-based society replaced band society everywhere. During the agricultural millennia to follow, the older Nilo-Saharan speech community gave birth to the modern languages of the eastern Chad, western Sudan region. Although these languages are related, they are not very closely related, a fact that testifies to the antiquity of each of the region's linguistic traditions. Distinguished friends, if some of you are from farm families, I apologize for belaboring the obvious, but my experience as a teacher has been mainly in the New York City area, where agricultural expertise among students is a commodity in very short supply. So let me explain that the life of farmers is difficult and controlled by the dictates of a nature that is not always kind. In the region we are examining, the basic food crops were millet and sorghum, dry land grains cultivated on swidden fields. Beer played an important dietary role because it provided a use for certain nutritious grain breeds that did not taste very good in any other form, but which could be stored successfully for unusually long periods. In the olden days, the family was the basic unit of production and consumption. Both men and women, and indeed children too, contributed vital forms of labor to the conduct of agriculture. In times of hardship and conspicuously drought, people had little choice but to flee their homes for more favored locales. Their hosts would typically incorporate the refugees into society as what someone has called artificial kinsmen or domestic slaves. Several indigenous forms of such servitude existed, but they had in common the feature that everybody knew that when good times returned, many of the slaves would flee back to their original homes. Each community also preserved an elaborate lore about the wild food resources of the region, and when necessary, farmers could survive for a time by reverting to an omnivorous hunting of small local animals and the gathering of wild hunger foods. Farm families also kept livestock, and by Roman times, all the region's major domesticates were in place: goats, sheep, chickens, cattle, and camels. The pigs, very characteristic of the Nubian-speaking community along the Nile, were not common in the West. Now, livestock represented the most concentrated form of wealth known, and a farmer who experienced a run of prosperity would normally convert his surplus wealth in the form of crops into cattle or camels. Speaking abstractly then, in the days before banks, the surplus wealth of the region tended to accumulate in the form of large livestock. At a very early date, people of the region came to understand that the possession of large livestock, in turn, made possible a second and different pastoral mode of livelihood. Cattle pastoralism probably came first and was widely practiced, but the coming of the camel made possible an extension of the highland communities even farther into the arid north. Now, two things may be said with some certainty about the relations between farmers and herdsmen in these early and distant times. Firstly, the pastoral way of life was always seen as preferable because it produced more and better quality food for less effort. And secondly, the pastoralists formed a regional elite who dominated the farmers while making politics among themselves. Competitive rivalries among elite elements, in turn, introduces the setting for the next major historical transition, the coming of the state. Now, the state form of government came to eastern Chad and the western Sudan at the close of what Europeans called the Middle Ages. An early dynasty of kings who spoke Dadju gave way to a second dynasty called the Tunjur, whose elegant but unexcavated stone-walled mountaintop fortress capital of Uri in northern Darfur was mentioned by the Italian Renaissance geographer Lorenzo Lanania. During the 16th century, however, the Tunjur realm bifurcated into two separate polities. In the east, a group called the Kera split away to found a new kingdom based upon the Fur-speaking community centered on the mountain range of Jebel Marra. The realm came to be known, logically enough, as the place where the Fur live, or Darfur. The Tunjur retained control of the west, where they reorganized their remaining holdings as a separate kingdom called Wadai, based upon the Boromabang-speaking community, with its capital at Abashe in the eastern part of what is now Chad. And for most of the 1500s and 1600s, Darfur and Wadai wrestled against each other for mastery of the Tunjur legacy. But ladies and gentlemen, the 18th century would be different. Meanwhile, it would be worthwhile to ask ourselves why the early modern people of this region needed a state form of government. For that matter, why does anybody need a government? Thomas Hobbes argued that without a strong king to impose order, life would be nasty, brutish, and short. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, on the other hand, argued that governments were established by the people as a whole to pursue the public good. John Locke tried to square this circle by introducing property as a third variable. Even Hobbes's nasties, once they had accumulated some tangible stake in society, could, he said, be governed rationally and moderately, because their own greed would temper their more aggressive other impulses. Modern anthropologists might say, by the close of the Middle Ages, warlike competition among the region's pastoral lineages and the self-aggrandizing chiefs who led them had reached crisis proportions. The majority would benefit from the rule of one to stop the destruction caused by the rivalries of the elite few. For these are the circumstances historically in which unbalanced lineage society led by competitive big men gives way to monarchy. Moving from theory to practice, let's examine a few basic features of the state in Darfur. In terms of subsistence economy, Darfur remained a land of farmers and herdsmen. Most forms of wealth came from the land. In terms of language and culture, Darfur was a polyethnic imperial structure. The Kera kings spoke Fur, while their subjects spoke not only Fur, but perhaps 20 other Nilo-Saharan languages, some of which, and conspicuously Tunjur, are no longer with us today. Like other state societies, Darfur was characterized by the existence of distinct social classes. In the beginning, these were only two, and they were defined by their relation to the basic source of wealth in the region, the land. The elite, personified by the king, claimed to own all the land. The subjects, in return for the right to live on the king's land and earn a living there, must give payments to the elite, both in kind and in labor services. As one informant from the subject class put it, the government ate taxes. As one king from the ancient Daju dynasty put it, revenues can derive only from that which exists. For centuries thereafter, the subjects paid and the kings ate. I believe that the 18th century represented the apogee of Darfur history, at least so far. The kings of that age made peace with Wadai. The two realms then turned back to back and directed their power outward, both east and west. Wadai annexed Bagirmi and Darfur annexed Kordofan. By about 1800, a gigantic restored Tunjuriya extended all the way from Lake Chad to the Nile. The 19th century introduced to Darfur important changes in the domains of culture, economics, and politics. The details need not concern us, but we should pick out a few major trends. Let's begin with culture. Within the Islamic tradition, the question of how the believers should be organized has always been controversial, and as far as I know, there is no universally accepted right answer. The faith came to Darfur as a state cult promulgated by the kings, but at the local level, it included communities organized by holy men, sometimes immigrants, who operated within the tradition of Islamic mysticism called Sufism. The kings encouraged this activity and won the loyalty of the holy men through gifts of land, through tax exemptions, and other prerogatives. The 19th century, throughout the Islamic world, now witnessed the appearance of what historians call Neo-Sufism, a movement which introduced much larger scale and more highly centralized organizations than had ever previously existed. The rise of these large new organizations, in turn, could hardly fail to bear diplomatic, political, and socioeconomic implications for all concerned. Three of the new Neo-Sufi organizations impinged upon Darfur during the 19th century. From the west came the Tijaniya Brotherhood, commonly associated with merchants of West African background. From the north came the Sanusia Brotherhood, based in the Saharan oases of Libya and northern Chad. As the century progressed, the Sanusia became increasingly important to Darfur as intermittent partners in an exchange of slaves for guns. However, the connection remained controversial because it was Wadai and not Darfur who was normally the preferred Sanusi client in the south. And finally, near the close of the 19th century, Darfur became involved with a movement based upon the belief that a Nile Valley Nubian man from Dongola named Muhammad Ahmed was the expected Mahdi, a controversial figure in Islamic eschatology. The Tijani influence upon Darfur was modest and benign, but the Sanusi and Mahdist movements each established connections between Darfur and the outside world, connections that helped lay the groundwork for the current crisis. Henceforth, and long after Neo-Sufism as a movement had atrophied, all the successive governments of both Libya and the Nile Valley would feel free to include Darfur in their calculations and schemes. Now let's consider a second important 19th century theme, the coming of commercial capitalism. But first, some context. The discipline of economic anthropology reminds us that we all conduct our business in a variety of distinct spheres of exchange, each sphere characterized by a unique nexus of types of participants, types of items traded, and types of relations to the government and to wider society. For example, I may go down to my local Dodge dealer and buy a pickup truck. If I seem to have good credit, he's not going to ask me a lot of personal questions. But if I miss a payment, I can count on it that a repo man with a court order will come and tow the truck away. But suppose I buy a couple dozen grams from my local cocaine dealer and somehow don't get around to paying him. In this case, I can count on it that I will not be taken to court, but I may well have my head blown off. It's a different sphere of exchange. Or again, to choose a third example, if the little girl next door knocks on my door selling Girl Scout cookies, I will probably buy some, however much I may actually loathe the stuff. If I insist on stiffing the kid perhaps by paying with a counterfeit $5 bill manufactured on my own color Xerox, probably nothing at all is going to happen to me, except that as long as my neighbor lives, he will tell everybody for miles around what a jerk I am. So three different spheres of exchange. Now let's look at Darfur. In the olden days, the kings of Darfur and Wadai ran a carefully managed economy in which everything valuable enough to be exported was collected by the king through his taxation system and then sent abroad via royally sponsored caravans. On their return, these expeditions brought back weapons and luxury consumption goods with which the king equipped his slave army and rewarded his loyal courtiers and family. Noteworthy was the absence of a middle class of people who made their living through trade. In fact, there were no towns in the ordinary sense in all of Darfur and Wadai, just the royal capitals inhabited by the kings, their courts, and their servants, and at some periods a designated settlement where foreign traders who accompanied the royal caravans were allowed to sit waiting for the departure of the next expedition back to their homes. Now, Wadai was able to preserve this system right up to its conquest by the French in 1909. The foreign traders who sat at their designated spot outside Abashe were mainly agents of the Sanusia, and their commerce was largely in what documents of the day called alat daula, or tools of state, meaning weapons, and slaves. But in Darfur, however, the same kings of the late 18th century who struck east to the Nile, annexing Kordofan, also initiated an economic perestroika, an infitah, or opening of their economies to the idea and the practice of free market exchange. And the new commerce was primarily a trade in slaves. The kings of Darfur opened a new trade route to Egypt along a difficult desert route called the 40 Days Road. They began franchising the Salatiya, or government-sponsored slave-gathering expedition, to private entrepreneurs, some of foreign origin, as well as people of native origin. More numerous raids naturally produced a more abundant supply of slaves. The new trade needed expertise, it needed venture capital, and both were to be found among the middle classes of Nile Valley society. Darfur welcomed an influx of Eastern traders, who over the course of the 19th century founded markets and established small towns throughout Darfur. The older royal sphere of commerce did not stop, but it faded in relative significance as a new sphere of private commerce grew. Yet in Darfur, as elsewhere, the rise of a numerous and powerful middle class was likely to have profound political implications. So let us now turn to politics, our third important 19th century historical theme. In 1820, the Turkish government of Egypt invaded the Sudan, conquering the Nile Valley kingdom of Sennar and seizing Kordofan from Darfur. By the 1830s, the Turks had penetrated the great equatorial swamps of the Sud and began the systematic looting of South Sudan for ivory and slaves. The exploitation of the South was soon turned over to private enterprise, and most of the men who participated in it were Arabized Nubians, erstwhile subjects of Sennar. In time, they developed new and violent predatory regimes based upon the enslavement of South Sudanese, and their power within and over the region grew. In the year 1874, Darfur fell to a pair of simultaneous attacks from the colonial government in Khartoum and from the leading southern warlord, Zubair Rahman Mansur. Yet before power could be consolidated over Darfur, the whole Turkish Sudan was convulsed by the rise of the Mahdist movement. This enjoyed enough support in Darfur to ensure the eviction of the colonial regime there. However, a royalist insurgency led by the old Kera dynasty never faltered throughout both the Turkish and the Mahdist periods. And when, in 1898, the Mahdist state in turn fell to a second Egyptian invasion, this time led by the British, a young Fur prince named Ali Dinar returned from Omdurman to Darfur and restored his kingdom. Ali Dinar ruled Darfur from 1898 until 1916. He helped Wadai resist French encroachment until its fall in 1909, and he developed ever closer diplomatic and commercial relations with the Sanusia Brotherhood, who had meanwhile united much of Libya in opposition to Italian ambitions there. The Senussis facilitated the sale of Ali Dinar's slaves and ivory and supplied him with guns and ammunition. He sent significant quantities of food and camels, as well as vigorous moral support, to help the Libyans and the Ottomans resist Italy. The outbreak of World War I led the British to invade Darfur, now seen as a supporter of the Central Powers, and annex it to the Nile Valley, Sudan. And in truth, that's all we need to know about the 19th century. Britain and Egypt ruled the Sudan jointly from 1898 to 1956 in a second colonial regime called the Condominium. Three things worth mentioning happened in Darfur. Firstly, the urban middle-class culture introduced in the previous century by immigrants from the Nile Valley grew in influence and began to extend into the countryside. Urban merchants asserted control over rural clients by means of extending credit on terms that could never be repaid, while urban values, such as female circumcision, spread among communities where such things were previously unknown. In addition to questions regarding the status and activities of women, some features of Darfur rural society that were particularly vulnerable to urban middle-class critique were the consumption of beer and the eating of hunger foods such as the tortoise, the waran or monitor lizard, and the rock hyrax, which were not Islamically legitimate or halal. Secondly, in order to meet the tax obligations imposed by the condominium regime, many men from Darfur migrated to sell their labor on plantations in the east, where cotton cultivation on an industrial scale was proving profitable. The revived 20th century Mahdist movement, now encouraged by the British as a counterweight to Egyptian-based Unity of the Nile Valley nationalism, took the lead in organizing the flow of labor eastward, and Syed Abdurrahman al-Mahdi established a strong political presence in Darfur. Enough men left Darfur in this age to begin there the de-skilling of agriculture, which to an ever-increasing degree passed into the hands of women and children. Thirdly, the condominium authorities did very little in Darfur during the first half of the 20th century. Economically, they designated the realm a labor reservoir where no development should be allowed because any viable local source of income would impede the outward flow of labor to plantations in the east. Politically, they froze the political system of Darfur and kept it just as they found it. They made a sincere and reasonably successful effort to comprehend the structure of the old administration. However, they clearly failed to appreciate the system of statecraft practiced by the old kings, for that relied upon an endless process of redrawing the boundaries of fiefs, the reorganization and redefinition of groups of subjects, the appointment of new levels of administration to outrank the old, and, but by no means least, the management of pastoral elites through the reward of the loyal but weak, upwardly mobile, through the reduction of the rebellious mighty. The British adopted the last independent generation of mighty as their clients, and, not fearing them, thanks to modern military technology, never faltered in their commitments. The weaker pastoral groups, who in earlier days could reasonably have hoped to better themselves through loyal support of the king against their present social betters, now found themselves locked out permanently. By the 21st century, these excluded minor pastoral groups would be among the easiest to manipulate as a new generation of overlords resumed the ancient processes of rewriting ethnicity and redistributing wealth. I believe it would be correct to say that the present crisis in Darfur began with the end of colonial rule at mid-20th century. By your willingness to come here and participate today, for which I'm very appreciative indeed, by the way, I infer that unlike most Americans, you could probably actually locate Chad, Libya, and the Sudan on a world map. As ungrateful as it may seem, alas, I am now going to ask you to forget the geography you know for the moment, in order to reconfigure the region through the eyes of the first generation to experience independence over the last half of the 20th century. Many people felt, with some justification, that the colonial borders were absurd. They assumed, and they certainly hoped, that a more rational share out of territory would be forthcoming when the Europeans went home. Unfortunately, although many people shared these views, they did not necessarily agree among themselves on what changes should be made. So, with your permission, let us consider some possible alternative viewpoints. It seemed obvious to many people in Darfur and Wadai that their homelands at some level belonged together. At a minimum, the free movement of goods and people back and forth across historical Tunjuriya should be facilitated, and no outsider should be allowed to disturb local arrangements that benefited members of the community. Such were the views, for example, of the prominent Fur politician Ahmed Durej, equally welcome as a successful merchant in Abashe and El Fasher. Libya achieved independence under the rule of the contemporary leader of the Sanusia Brotherhood, King Idris. From the perspective of Benghazi, both Darfur and Wadai belonged to the vast dominion united by a history of Sanusi loyalties, a realm that extended from Darfur westward into Niger and from the Mediterranean southward to the Central African Republic. Since 1969, Libya has been ruled by Muammar al-Gaddafi, who had little sympathy for the Sanusia, but who was more than willing to adopt their view of the Southlands, and particularly Chad.